Welcome to A Cup of Kai. I'm your co-host, Blaine Lewis.
And I'm your other co-host, Karthik Mahadevan. Today, we'll be telling you a little bit about what's on the menu and serving up some samples.
We're super excited to bring you this new podcast. We've been talking about it and working on it for months now. This podcast is about human-computer interaction, something Karthik and I are both really excited about. And we're hoping we can use this podcast to excite you as much as we are. In the first half of this episode, we're going to tell you a little bit about the origin of A Cup of Kai and also tell you a bit about our plan for what an episode is going to look like. Then in the second half, we're excited to interview each other and give you a little taste of what future episodes are actually going to be like. So Karthik, tell me a little bit about why we're starting this podcast.
So I'm a huge fan of podcasts, and it's a medium that I'm very comfortable consuming. Being really interested in HCI, I noticed that the communication in this field and science in general is limited to academic papers for the most part. And our field is quite vast and it's constantly expanding. And so one of the motivations of starting this podcast was to make our field more accessible to a more diverse audience, both within the field, but also in industry and other audiences. So Blaine, tell me about the origin of A Cup of Kai.
So this idea kind of stems from one of the most influential things that I've experienced in my career as a graduate student. And ironically enough, that's going for walks to grab coffee. It started at Waterloo, where we would often walk to the Starbucks, either taking the longest way and going through the buildings to avoid the snow and cold, or as a chance to get some fresh air and we'd walk outside, in the summer of course. But we'd always have these super engaging conversations about research. Even though they were called coffee walks, they were never really about the coffee. In fact, I remember at least once we all got to Starbucks and realized that none of us actually wanted anything from Starbucks. And it kind of just goes to show that these were always more about research and community than anything else. So our hope with this podcast is that Karthik and I can share some of those conversations with you, our listeners, and kind of show you a little bit about what our field is like and create a little bit of a more community and give you a cup of Kai, I guess. And so the other part about this too is we spent a lot of time thinking about a name, and I was hoping, Karthik, that you could tell us, like, how did we come up with this? What does it mean?
Sure. So Kai is an acronym for a flagship research conference in our field, the field of human-computer interaction. And so Kai stands for human-computer interaction. And so our hope is that through these podcasts, we can communicate bits of interesting research from our really kind of vast field in a very digestible way. Sort of like having a cup of coffee or a cup of tea.
We've talked a little bit about what A Cup of Kai is and the idea of the podcast name and kind of the atmosphere that we want to promote, but we haven't really told you about what a typical episode is going to be like. So the way a typical episode is going to look like is we're going to invite one of these guests and we're going to interview them or talk to them. And that's going to make up the majority of the episode. But we also have a couple of small segments planned. The one that is kind of our namesake segment is called A Cup of Kai. And I'm especially super excited about this because this is kind of our chance to show groundbreaking or important or foundational research to a broader audience. And what we're going to do is we're going to invite somebody who has a recently published paper, or maybe not, somebody who's published a paper, and we're going to invite them to give us a 2 to 3 minute pitch on their paper, and then you can listen to them. And we're actually planning on like archiving these on our website so that you can go through and just listen to a bunch of cups of Kai whenever you'd like. It's almost like that, what is it, paper in 2 minutes that goes on YouTube, I think it's called, 60-second papers. Do you know what I'm talking about, Karthik?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's a very interesting channel on YouTube.
Yeah, you've probably seen it. And so we're hoping that this is kind of a podcasty version of that as a segment. And we'll have one of those in each of our episodes. And then we have another segment called a literature review that I think Karthik can tell us a little bit more about.
Sure. So in the literature review, we're hoping to have people come in and give us a short segment, let's say 2 to 5 minutes. And we're hoping that somebody who's coming in can give us a very quick overview of the field that they're kind of working in. So for instance, if someone's working in the field of fabrication, we'd like to know, you know, what are the kind of key papers in this area? Who are the kind of researchers that are working in that space? And so this gives us, I guess, gives everyone a chance to get a very quick kind of taste of this specific area of research. And some of the typical questions they're hoping they'll be answering through this literature review is, for instance, what are some of the interesting works that are, you know, that one might be excited about? What are some of the foundational results in the field? And what are some of the open problems that are kind of being explored?
And so when we bring all of this together, what we end up with is an episode that kind of just like goes really deep into a topic and hopefully explores some of the smaller issues and some of the bigger issues. And so the way it'll look is we're going to start the episode off by having our guest tell us the literature review, or one of our guests, sorry. And then we'll go into an interview with a guest and we can talk about some of that field somehow. And each of these conversations are kind of going to just take their own way. We'll prepare some questions to interview our guests with. And we're also just kind of hoping to have kind of a very natural feel to it. So we don't want anything too prepared. We're probably going for like a semi-structured interview, I guess. And then we'll round the episode off with a cup of Kai, where we'll have a paper and somebody will give us a 2 to 3 minute pitch on that. And all of this for our usual typical episode is all going to be focused on one topic. And that means that even you don't have to listen to our podcast for every single different topic. You can just listen to the topics you're interested in and you'll just get like a bunch of content just about that particular subfield of HCI. We've got a bunch of really fun special episodes planned. But our bread and butter is going to be centered around inviting a guest, maybe multiple guests, and then we're going to spend an entire episode diving into some subfield of HCI.
So we're hoping to have different types of guests on our podcast, and we think that doing so will give us a lot of interesting perspectives. So for instance, a master's student who has just published their first paper will bring us a very different perspective than a professor who has been in the field for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, and published a lot in all these different areas. So we're hoping that this diverse set of guests will give you a very interesting taste of our field. And more importantly, we're also planning to have guests that have different areas of expertise and research interests. So for instance, we may have someone who's doing human-robot interaction, or for instance, someone who's doing fabrication research.
And we've already got two episodes lined up for you. One of them isn't our bread and butter, because we wanted to start off by defining what HCI even is. I know if you asked me to define HCI, I'd struggle a lot. I'd probably just stutter at you for a minute and throw a bunch of ideas at you. And it's really hard to define HCI. So what we were hoping to do is, rather than coming up with some canonical definition of what HCI is, we're going to invite a bunch of people we know and a bunch of people from across HCI to give us a panel. And we're going to ask them each to give us their own experience of what HCI is to them. And then Karthik's got a great episode planned as well.
So we have another interesting episode lined up, which is about human-robot interaction. So this is a field that I work in and I'm really passionate about. So robots are super cool and super exciting, but they're very hard to build. There's a lot of technical challenges. But once you kind of surmount those, there's still a lot of interesting kind of challenges that we need to tackle so that, you know, we can have robots in our society and in our future. So for instance, imagine a self-driving car. Like, there's all these technical challenges of making sure the car is able to drive safely without, you know, causing accidents and things like that. But there's a lot of social problems that we still haven't really solved. For instance, like if I'm a pedestrian and I'm trying to cross the street today, how can I deal with, you know, how can I feel safe when I'm crossing the street and a self-driving car is, you know, coming and driving towards me? Or if I'm a passenger inside these vehicles, like how do I feel safe? How do I know that this car is actually, you know, able to take me from point A to point B safely so that I can kind of focus on things that I really care about? So for instance, I want to work or I want to spend time with my family in these cars. And so that's kind of what human-robot interaction is trying to solve. So
we also talked a little bit about what else we want to cover in this like first or zeroth episode of our podcast. And we don't have any guests yet because we don't have a podcast yet. So we thought the easiest place to start would be to like kind of pretend we're the guests today. And so Karthik, I'm going to interview Karthik, and then Karthik's going to interview me. I know a little bit about his research, but honestly, as his lab mate, I probably don't know enough. And so we thought this would be just kind of a fun opportunity to like get to know a little bit about the past research we've done, and then a little bit more about like what kind of research we want to do. And yeah, we thought this would be a great opportunity for you as a listener to get to know us as the hosts as well. And maybe that'll help you understand where we're coming from when we ask questions or talk to the guests as well. So I guess I can start this off. There's a motorcycle driving by. It's gone now. Okay, so I thought I'd start this off. And Karthik, you've said a couple times now, I think, that you do human-robot interaction, but I don't think that I fully understand what that means. So can you kind of just explain to me what you think human-robot interaction is?
Sure. That is putting me on the spot slightly because it's a pretty good question, but I'll try my best. So for me, human-robot interaction is designing robots, I guess, as the name says, designing robots to interact with people. And so it covers a huge spectrum of things. So it includes things like, how can we design robots to look potentially more human-like to get people to interact with it better? It also comes to things like, you know, how can we design the conversation of interaction between a human and a robot? It can be how the robot should respond to a human and its behavior and a human's behavior. So, you know, if we're working together on something, how should the robot respond to me making a mistake? Or how can I design the robot so that, you know, when the robot makes a mistake, I can still continue working with it? And so it kind of covers a huge array of things. I specifically have, in the last couple of years, been working on this kind of subtopic of human, I guess, autonomous vehicle pedestrian interaction, which I would say is kind of in the middle, somewhere between human-computer interaction and human-robot interaction. And I specifically focused on designing technology, I guess in this case, interfaces, to help autonomous vehicles communicate with pedestrians. So how can we build interfaces that allow autonomous vehicles, which don't have a driver on board, to communicate with pedestrians while they're making street crossing decisions. And so that's kind of the space that I've been operating in the last couple of years. And so that's what I've been spending all my effort, I guess. Yeah.
Cool. You mentioned something interesting there, which is like it's between human-computer interaction and human-robot interaction. HRI, is it a subfield of HCI or is it not a subfield?
I guess it depends who you ask. So some people would put it as a subfield of HCI. Some people would say that it's a blend of robotics, psychology, human-computer interaction, potentially other kind of subfields. So I think it kind of lies in this fluid spectrum of all these different things. And it's not a one-dimensional spectrum. It's like, I don't know, five-dimensional or something like that.
Okay. And I've been hearing a lot about HRI only recently, though. Like I guess I didn't even know it was a thing 3 years ago, I guess, which was probably because I was just starting my master's. But
right.
So how old is the field? Can you give me a feel for like, has it gotten like a huge amount more popular recently or?
So I believe the first human robot interaction conference was like 15 years or less ago.
Oh, wow.
I think we're at the 16th or 17th iteration of the conference. So actually, it's quite a young field. And I think it's definitely growing in popularity, growing in attendance, growing in, you know, publications and papers from people, and also like the kinds of work that is considered human-robot interaction has also kind of evolved, right? So now we have artificial intelligence researchers that are working in human-robot interaction. We have designers in human-computer interaction that are involved in that. So I think it's very much like a diverse, especially nowadays, it's becoming even more diverse.
Awesome. That's really cool. I guess my next question is also going to put you on the spot, and they're probably all going to put you on the spot. I'm sorry, but you're going to have to deal with it. So I guess my next question is, in HCI, we're really proud of like kind of our heroes, I guess. There's Larry Tesler, who unfortunately I believe passed away recently, which is incredibly sad, and we're sorry for his loss. But he introduced copy and paste, and that's kind of something that is just like, it's ubiquitous throughout computing now. And it kind of came from academia. And I think as HCI researchers, we're really proud of that. And there's a couple other things like the Xerox PARC kind of had a huge influence, and there's the mother of all demos, and there's all these like classical academic things that are kind of a part of our pop culture now. Is there anything like that from HRI that the HRI people are just kind of like super proud of?
I don't think we're at that point yet. So we're starting to see some of the research that people have been doing in the last, I don't know, 15 years, springing into life with, you know, startups that are introducing robots. Like there's the Jibo, which was a home robot that was introduced by a startup from like a spinoff from MIT by human robot interaction researchers. So I guess like I think we're still kind of waiting for that moment. I don't think we're there yet. So I don't think human robot interaction has those kind of heroes necessarily. We have a lot of researchers in the field that are, you know, very much renowned for their work and that have contributed a lot to the field in this short period that they've been working in this field. But I wouldn't say necessarily we have a, you know, because human-computer interaction is a much, much older field. It's been around for much longer. It has a for much sure. larger impact, I guess, in general, in the last, you know, times that it's been around, yeah.
That's a really good point. And I guess with human-computer interaction, we were around when, like, computers started to move towards personal computing, right? So there was this huge opportunity for some ideas to spread back into popular culture, I guess. And I guess we don't really have personal robotics, I'm going to call it, quite yet. But I think at some point we will. And I guess we're just waiting on that point, and maybe that's when we'll start to see some more bleed over. So right before this, I was reading a paper by Karthik, and it's kind of, he's super well known for this paper. I'm super impressed by it, and it's a great paper, and it's titled Communicating Awareness and Intent in Autonomous Vehicle-Pedestrian Interaction. Do you want to tell me, like, can you give me, like, the elevator pitch of this paper?
Sure. So I guess I can start by motivating it. So it's kind of what I mentioned slightly earlier, which is that, you know, we're starting to see autonomous vehicle technology being developed, and we're expecting to see these vehicles on our road in the near future. We're already seeing some of this on our streets. But the biggest problem that we currently are going to most likely face is that today when we make street crossing decisions at crosswalks or anywhere, when we interact with vehicles, we not only interact with vehicles, we also interact with drivers inside the vehicles. And so we exchange nonverbal communication cues between the driver and pedestrians ourselves, in addition to vehicle cues that are part of the vehicle regardless. But in autonomous vehicles, we're going to lose the driver. This work is essentially targeting how can we replace the loss of driver cues. So in the future, when we have autonomous vehicles, fully autonomous vehicles that don't have a driver on board, how can these vehicles maintain that communication, that nonverbal communication that we've lost? How can we kind of augment these vehicles so that, you know, we can replace that loss? And so that replacement is kind of a series of ideas that we came up with that we're kind of, I guess, trying to build out a design space for what kind of solutions one may design for vehicles of the future that are autonomous, I guess. So that's basically what this paper is about. You know?
So what's the answer? How do we, I understand it's probably an open area of research and there is no real answer, but tell me how you think this is going to, what is this going to look like when it's in the real world? How are you going to know when you can cross the road when there's a car that has no driver?
Right. So I think that the main thing this paper tried to answer is like, there is this distinct, I guess there's like this kind of debate in the community, which is like, do we need to do anything about this? Can cars just use their movement? And is it not enough just to have movement so that we can communicate?
Sorry, what's movement in this case?
So movement is basically the car's locomotion. So the car is moving, it is driving, so we can use movement, and especially in human robot interaction, there's a lot of work on how movement of robots means something. So, you know, if a vehicle in this case slows down early or slows down late, these things mean something as a pedestrian. So if I were to see a driver who's slowing down super late, I might be much more cautious when I'm trying to cross, as opposed to a vehicle that, you know, maybe started slowing down much earlier. So this information is still relevant in autonomous vehicles, but the question was, could we get away with just that? And so this paper was looking at, you know, what if we didn't have this communication, which seems like is the status quo, or potentially the future status quo, and then this alternate reality, which is, let's put something on vehicles, let's make interfaces on these vehicles. And so the question was the question we wanted to answer. And I think the answer we came up with, which was that we probably need interfaces because they seem to help pedestrians. The question is obviously, how do we design these interfaces? And that's very much an open question, even in this work and past this work. So we really don't know the answer. Perhaps visual cues are something we can use, perhaps multimodal interfaces, which is the combination of like cues that are visual, for instance, plus audio cues, plus maybe haptic or vibration or something else, but essentially multimodal interfaces may be the solution. So that's maybe the most definitive answer I can give at this point about what that might look like. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks a lot. There's like, so I guess in my own life, did you consider things like you could use a horn, right? Like there's already these like existing things that the car could use. Did you try using a horn in this research?
So in this research, we didn't focus on the horn. I think we mostly, so we used nonverbal cues as well. Like we considered them, but I think in the end we chose verbal cues just because it was a design decision that, you know, we want to play with verbal cues. I think horns are something we didn't target necessarily because there's still kind of, there's this connotation that horns is like a negative thing. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't really want to play into that. And I think that's the main reason we didn't test like honking as a mechanism for communicating with someone. So typically you don't hear someone honking when they, you know, want you to do something as a positive reinforcement, typically, I don't know. And so that's the main reason we didn't focus on honking, I guess, yeah.
Interesting, okay, good. I'm kind of glad about that. I think people who know me know that I kind of low-key think that horns are like the plague of society living in Toronto. It drives me nuts. You know, you'll be walking down the street and somebody the light turns green and like 500 milliseconds later, the person behind them who is just like laying on their horn and it drives me nuts. And I think this is really cool because we talked a little bit about the boundary between like academia and the real world. And if somebody from the real world would have read this and seen that you want to use horns, and maybe they would have used horns in autonomous vehicles. And I think this is kind of an interesting question, which is like, researchers almost have an opportunity and an obligation, in my opinion, to get rid of horns for autonomous vehicles. And I guess that might have a quality of life improvement in cities. And I think it's really cool to see here, there's real potential for our research to bleed into the real world. And we should really consider stuff like this, like people like me who hate horns. We're important, I promise. Cool, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Cool. I really like hearing about your research. We talked a little bit about your paper, and you have more than one paper as well. This is kind of just like, this is Karthik, like, I don't know, this is absolutely fantastic work. It's really thorough and well done. The figures in the paper are gorgeous, and Karthik also, and his co-authors as well, do a really good job of like laying out kind of the design space and all the different ways that you can actually like create communication between a pedestrian and an autonomous vehicle, which I think is just, it's really cool. It's really good work. I recommend you read it. It's extremely well done. There's a reason that it's well cited. But I kind of wanted to move on a little bit. And rather than talking about the work that Karthik did, I also wanted to use this as an opportunity for us to get to know our hosts. And so I wanted to ask you, like, who are you, Karthik? How did you get here? Why are you here? Why did you want to start a podcast? Just throw some words at me.
Sure. So maybe I can start with how I got to the field of HCI and research in general. So my background is I did an undergrad in electrical engineering with no intention, or didn't even know what HCI was when I was in my undergrad. So I finished my undergrad.
And just a small note there. Karthik and I actually both went to the same university, the University of Alberta. And I had the same experience. I also didn't know what HCI was. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Absolutely. You can keep talking. No. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so actually, we also want to mention at some point how we met each other, because it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know each other at the University of Alberta. We just happened to meet here at the University of Toronto. So I did my engineering degree, and I started volunteering at a research lab, and I was interested in robotics, and I found a professor at the University of Calgary who was working in the space of human-robot interaction. I had a meeting with him about potentially like working on a project with him. He had a Segway robot that he just received to do research, and he asked me if I wanted to do something with the Segway robot, which is like this little two-wheeled robot that you ride around, which is super fun to drive around. I tried it out, and I was like, sure, I'm hooked. I can, worst case, I can drive this around for a couple months. and so that's kind of how I started working in the space. And we thought about how we could study, pedestrians and autonomous vehicles. And it was kind of very broad at that point. And that's kind of how I got into this field of research. And then as I started reading more and more about human-robot interaction, I found myself really, really excited by it and wanted to continue in that space. So I pursued my master's at the University of Calgary, and then, I wanted to continue further. And so I applied to the University of Toronto because of, its fantastic HCI, human-computer interaction research, kind of groups and professors. And so, I got lucky and I'm here. So, that's my story so far.
Cool. And that's a lot about you professionally, but like outside of research, who is Karthik?
I don't even know. I'm still trying to figure that out myself. I guess I am... I like playing video games. I like reading, and I like cooking. I don't know. That's kind of what I like doing.
Cool. Yeah. Now that we're in like quarantine life right now, and we're gonna try not to talk about that too much, but what video games? What are you playing right now?
Oh, I play a lot of Call of Duty. That's my thing. I have a bunch of friends who play it with me, so yeah, we play a lot of Call of Duty when I'm not doing research, which nowadays is kind of it's hard. It's hard to make that distinction.
It's so hard. It's a really tough time. Awesome.
Cool. So let's get into you, Blaine.
I was hoping to ask some more questions so we didn't have to talk about questions. Me. I guess we can move on to me if we need to.
Cool. Let's do it. So I guess I want to start with that first question, which is like, how did you get into HCI? Because you mentioned, you didn't know what HCI was when you were in your undergrad. So what made you pursue research in HCI? Or like, what got you into this field? Like, what is it that got you interested in HCI?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to say what got me into HCI. It's a big combination of a bunch of things. I always tell people when I think about programming, I think of it like Lego. Like I get to build something and just mess around with things, and it's very tangible, right? And I've always loved that aspect of it. Like I think the first program I wrote that I showed other people was like I recreated, like I made a slideshow out of Adobe Flash, so I could, rather than doing PowerPoint, and it was so dumb, like. It didn't really work properly, but it was I was really young when it did this, and I was so excited about it. And I love the fact that I can like build something and show it to people. And so that's kind of where the human comes from. And I guess my experience with the computer science has always had something to do with that. And then I guess I had an internship at Microsoft when I was in my undergrad, and it was a program manager internship. And there was this thing, it really blew me away, because I did a little bit of UX design. I had no idea what I was doing. And I did a study where I watched these account managers, and they're these brilliant people. Like they look at a spreadsheet of numbers and they can figure out things that like, I just don't understand. Like, imagine just like rows and rows of numbers, and they're all of these different metrics capturing like advertising and stuff like this. And I don't even know what most of them mean or how they interact with each other. And they stare at this spreadsheet and they instantly make a decision. And it's like they're obviously extremely talented domain experts. And then I watch them use a computer and I'm like, what are you doing? Like you don't click the copy button from edit. Like you're so slow. Like, how are you so smart at one thing, and then you're so ignorant about how to use computers, and it just kind of blew me away. And I still remember that to this day. I think it's crazy how people who are so smart about one thing can just like know so little about another. And I guess I kind of just saw it as my mission to be able to I want to be able to bring more efficiency and productivity to these people in their everyday lives. And I guess that kind of drives a bunch of my research and some of the things I'm interested in. And so from there, I think it was called UROC at the University of Waterloo Undergraduate Research Opportunities Conference. Mm-hmm. And I went there, and it was for like 2 days or something like that. And I had a chance to work on not HCI, but bioinformatics, which I did not do. I don't do anything with bioinformatics, but I did meet, I met my master's advisor there, Professor Daniel Vogel. And I don't know, we just kind of hit it off. He did a bunch of really cool research, and he showed me some of the stuff his students are doing, met some of his students. They were all like super cool. They're fantastic. And I was like, you know what? I think I want to do a master's. So I applied, I got into Waterloo. And then from there, the rest is history, I guess. Now I do research in HCI, I guess. So yeah, right. I guess that's where it started. It's a long journey, I guess.
I find your story very interesting, because like typically people who are like myself, I got into HCI because I ended up working in something along those lines. You mentioned that it feels like you were really inspired to do HCI from your experience working in industry, which is just super cool, because that's a different experience than mine. Mm-hmm. So I guess my next question is, like, you mentioned a little bit about how your research focuses on how we can improve productivity of people who are using technology or software. And specifically, I want to get into, I guess, your research directions and what you've been working on so far, I guess, in your master's. By the way, extremely impressive CV this guy has. We're your first year into the PhD before you even start working on your PhD work. He already has 4 publications at top tier venues. So amazing.
Nice.
Specifically, I wanted to ask you, what made you get into, or what made you interested in keyboard shortcuts? And I guess before I get into that, like, maybe if you had to give your elevator pitch about your research, not specifically a project, but your research directions, like, what is it? Is it optimizing to people's use of technology, or is it something else?
Yeah, I guess that's a tough question, because I feel like my research is kind of sort of like in this inflection point where it's evolving a little bit. What's the elevator pitch of my research? I'm shifting from the research I've done to more like, I'm really interested in understanding people and why they make the decisions they do. It's really hard. I feel bad now for putting you on the spot, because I have no idea. I guess my elevator pitch is, I have this one thing, and this is kind of something I'm pretty interested in. I'm really interested in making computers, believe it or not, harder to use. I think that kind of UX designers are all like, oh, we should be making every little thing easier to use. And I think we're actually kind of making a mistake there, because there's this idea in human, or like, I guess it's more in psychology, and it's called satisficing. And it's the basic idea that when you make a decision, you have to decide, like, your decision costs money, or not, it doesn't cost money, sorry, your decision costs you like energy and time. So if I have to choose between 5 options, rather than choosing the optimal one, because inspecting each one actually takes some energy, which adds to the cost, you actually choose the one that's good enough. So if the first one you look at is good enough, then you stop looking at the rest. And it doesn't matter how much better the last one is. Like, it could be so much better that you should definitely choose that one all the time. If you're a satisficer, you just don't look at that. And I think when we have interfaces that are too easy to use, what happens is that people satisfy. So they look at the first one and it's good enough already. So they use buttons. They never use keyboard shortcuts. But maybe if you made buttons a little bit harder to use, they'd look at keyboard shortcuts and at least consider them. And I think once we get over that threshold and that bump, maybe we could see people be more efficient. Keyboard shortcuts are kind of a small target. And the reason I kind of choose keyboard shortcuts is because they're everywhere. And when you talk to people, like, Karthik, how many keyboard shortcuts do you think you know? And and keep in mind that you're a computer scientist. You use computers almost all day. How many do you know?
I'd say like five, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe. This is the joke I make whenever I do a talk or when I talk to people here is like, yeah, five is about it, right? Like, you know, cut, copy, paste, undo, redo.
New tab on Chrome.
True. Yeah. Yeah. And so I guess I think it's just kind of, this is such like a present problem that I'm interested in it. And it's kind of easy, right? There aren't many competing factors. So it's something that we can really do research on. So yeah, I'm interested in keyboard shortcuts, I guess, but I'm also interested in a lot of other things too. And I'm sure we'll get to those. Did that answer any of your questions?
I think so. I think it's a pretty good start. So maybe let's get into your most recent paper, Keymap, which is, I can read out the title specifically. It says Keymap, Improving Keyboard Shortcut Vocabulary Using Norman's Mapping. So before I get into any of the details, tell the listeners, what is Norman's Mapping?
That was exactly where I was going to start. This is perfect. So as a little bit of an introduction. So Don Norman is kind of, I don't know if you've read the book, it's called Design of Everyday Things. Mm-hmm. And this is where he introduces natural mapping. And it's kind of just like this book about how to design things in general. It's fantastic. I highly recommend you read it. It's really good. And so natural mapping, the classic introduction of what it is or what it isn't, I guess, is a stove. So on a stove, the burners are laid out in a square. You have 1, 2, 3, 4. And then your controls for them are laid out in a totally different way, right? They're laid out in a line rather than a square. So there's really the mapping between the square and the line of burners and controls is arbitrary. You can choose it like you can do like clockwise or something like that, or you can do a bunch of things, but there's really no real connection between those two things. But imagine if rather than doing a square and a line, what if you instead organized the burners in a square and then also the controls into a square so that the top left is the top left, the top right is the top right, and then so on and so forth. And we see this exact same problem into how we design keyboard shortcuts and where they are. So the way that you figure out what a keyboard shortcut is by going into like that little menu across the top, you click on edit, you look at undo, and then when you look across, you see that it's Command Z. And so there's no real mapping between how to like enter Command Z as a novice and as an expert. And so kind of the goal of Keymap is to bring those two things together so that when a novice does it, it's the same as an expert. And really a lot of my research looks at this, and this is actually something called a rehearsal-based interface where a novice and an expert do the same thing rather than different things. So that's what Norman's mapping is, and that's how it applies to my research on keyboard shortcuts.
Right. So in this paper, you came up with a brand new interaction technique that allows people to kind of learn and then hopefully recollect these keyboard shortcuts at a much higher rate potentially than this like typical or traditional methods or other methods that people have come up with. So maybe if you could talk about specifically like your solution and why potentially you think that the solution can be better in the long run than a lot of other things that we've seen so far.
For sure. So I'll caveat this with, even though it's reasonably new, but it's almost not novel, which I think is one of the most interesting things about it. So we actually do see the same kind of interaction technique in Google, Chrome OS, I believe, has something fairly similar to this. And also we see this all the time, and this is the best way to describe it, is have you ever seen those like on a keyboard or on like, you can also get for your Mac, you can get like these little things that fold over your keyboard. And what they have on them is on top of copy, they write copy on it. And it's mm-hmm. the same thing. What Keymap does is when you press and hold a keyboard shortcut modifier, like Command or Option or Control or Alt, after a very small delay, a virtual keyboard shows up across the bottom of your screen. And displayed on that is the keyboard shortcuts you could enter. So on top of where C would be, you have copy. On top of V, you have paste. And there's a bunch of ideas behind why this is a good idea. So one of them is that it's no longer arbitrary why copy is Command C because it's there. And it also creates like these physically spatially located groupings, right? Like cut, copy, and paste are actually beside each other. Mm-hmm. They are spatially associated, but you don't really think of that. You don't see it. But with Keymap, when we display them like that, now you can suddenly see that those things are spatially related. And some other really cool things is there's this idea in psychology called stimulus response compatibility. And this was kind of more, this is more Andy's work on this. Andy Coburn is one of my co-authors on this paper. And so stimulus response compatibility is the idea that when the thing you do corresponds with like the stimulus you see, then you're going to be a little bit faster. And you, I believe there's some evidence that you'll remember it better. And so that's another thing that adds to it. And it's just a bunch of things that add up that mean that this is probably easier to remember, basically, as well as easier to or faster to enter.
Right. So one question I guess I have is like, so in this paper, you showed that, you know, using Keymap as an alternative to other methods. And so specifically in this paper, you compare to one method, the expose HK method. And you showed that this new interaction technique using Keymap performs better in the short run, but also in the long run. Mm-hmm. So how do you see this technology, I guess, being integrated into like software today? Because you mentioned that that's one of the driving factors of all your research is like, I don't just want to do academic research that, you know, one day I'll read it and then I'm excited about it. But actually, you want to see these ideas out there in the real world in real software. So could you tell us like how you envision this technology? Because I think this is a fascinating idea. Because I guess one thing that I always think about is like, physical keyboards, they don't have any associations because they're static, right? I mean, you have keys on a keyboard. They don't necessarily relate to, you know, what's actually happening in the software. And what you just said, where you have virtual mappings of the keyboard where, you know, for example, control or copy, paste, and cut are right next to each other in the virtual space, although physically they're kind of spread out or separated, is a super interesting way of designing the system. So I'm wondering two things, I guess. One is like, how do you envision this in the future, like on actual software? And two, why is it that we're still using keyboards like this? This is something that I've wondered. Like, why are we still using static keyboards? Why not use something like you're talking about?
Yeah, let's come back to that second question because I've got a bunch of thoughts on it. But let's start with the first question, which is how do I envision this being used? And the answer to that is that I actually think the future is now. As a part of my research, we've actually released this as a Chrome extension. You can go to the Google Chrome store right now and you can download it. It's only available for a couple of programs. I hope to improve that. It's open source though, so you can also improve it. But if you use Overleaf, as I suspect you might, you can download this now and it'll show you all of the keyboard shortcuts for Overleaf and you can use it right now. And hopefully it'll improve as I have more time to work on it. And then the other thing too is it's also being released as an NPM package. And what I mean by that is if you develop a web application, you can embed it in your website so that it just works and then other people can use it. So I guess I'm hoping to just popularize it a little bit so that we can drive a demand for people wanting these built into applications so that you can use a key map. And I think you said something really interesting, which I think is really cool and I can't wait for it to happen, is you said that you alluded to the idea that designers can take advantage of this, right? So when you choose keyboard shortcuts, because now they're arbitrary, right? It doesn't matter where I put find other than trying to map the first letter to it. But we obviously can't do that. There's only 26 letters, and the distribution of letters to first letter of word is not good enough to do that. So when designers do this, maybe they can put things together on the keyboard now, or maybe you can customize your shortcuts to go with the key map, right? I think there's a huge amount of potential for people to take this and run with it. And I hope that now that I've demonstrated that under some circumstances, it's possible that you can remember keyboard shortcuts better with this, by a large margin, by the way. We demonstrated that this like really works, which I think is really exciting. Second question. So Karthik's second question was, why are keyboards still static? The most dynamic thing about our keyboards right now, as on laptops anyways, is the idea that we can like change the backlight. And we can't even do that dynamically. As a programmer, I can't control them to make them spell things or whatever, right? Which would be another valuable thing we could do to like, and I think there's a research project on this where I think somebody like made the keyboard shortcut line up after you click on it on your keyboard. So like when you click bold on the screen, then B highlights so that next time you can hopefully learn that. So there is some work to making them more interactive. And in academia, we went even further than that. There's a bunch of projects. There's one that makes each key like an LED screen. There's another one, I think it's called Metamorph. So what they did is they made keys move up and down. I believe they augmented them. I think it's called Metamorph. And so there is actually a lot of work in academia to like improve the keyboard. But I think when it comes down to it, there's so much about keyboards that we like, it's just such a standard way of interacting that I don't think we want to mess with it. It's like keyboard interaction is like highly efficient. And people complain about it all the time. Like take the way that Macs have changed their keyboards. Like there's been so much argument, so many arguments about this, right? So I think a part of it is that people are kind of just scared to screw with it. A part of it is that they just work. And so we try not to mess with things that work. And then the other part of it is that in academia, we are doing this.
Right. I have one kind of follow-up question. So I noticed that Keymap is a visual mechanism to kind of help people obviously like see shortcuts, but also recollect them. And I'm wondering, like, do you ever fear that with something like Keymap that, you know, there is this kind of concern of visual kind of clutter. So there's this concept that, you know, we can only pay attention to a certain amount of things at any given moment. So how do you envision like Keymap kind of taking that problem and kind of making that problem like minimal? You know?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the only visual elements that Keymap has on the screen when it is unactivated is almost like your start menu in the bottom left. We actually show all of the modifier keys. And this is for a couple of reasons. So we need to show those because Keymap has an alternative way of interacting with it, which is you can click on it, right? So you can click your way through the keyboard. And this is for accessibility purposes and other purposes as well. It's kind of just nice to have different ways of doing it. Maybe one of your hands is busy, so you need to click through it. And then to your question, which was how do we deal with visual clutter? Is I don't have a great answer for that. So one of the answers is that we show things in the bottom left for the explicit reason that you don't really use the bottom left of your screen very much, right? Like we mostly focus on the center of the screen, especially vertically. So that's one answer to it. And then the other answer is that that's one of the benefits of keyboard shortcuts in general is that they reduce like visual distraction. And we can do that even further here, or not even further, but one of the ways that we mirror that is I talked a little bit about a small delay, which is something that I've also done a little bit of research on. And so when you press and hold the modifier, the keyboards or the shortcuts don't appear for a little while at least. So about a third of a second, and you can easily enter the rest of the keyboard shortcut in that amount of time. So when you normally interact with it, you don't actually have any visual occlusion. So for the most part, it's about equal with linear menus. And it even has the potential to reduce the amount of, or to increase the amount of usable screen space, because if we use this as our primary way of seeing commands and stuff, we can actually get rid of toolbars and stuff.
Menus and stuff again, yeah.
Yeah, and this is actually something that reviewers talked about a little bit too, and we try and discuss it as much as we can in the paper, which is there's this idea of like replacement versus augmentation. So when we ran our study, we studied replacement, which means that you don't have toolbars or anything anymore. And then, but in a more realistic scenario, I can't see people adopting it necessarily that wholeheartedly. So maybe more augmentation is more realistic. So I guess we do use up a little bit of extra screen space, but I think it's probably worth it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe taking a little bit more broad, a more higher level perspective, maybe for listeners out there and myself, because I'm not a keyboard shortcuts researcher, I don't know the history of the space. Perhaps because you've done your literature review and we talked about the whole segment of, you know, having you know, researchers talk about, you know, the state of their field. I'd love to hear your thoughts on like how the field has evolved, not necessarily, you know, who are the, you know, key players necessarily, but, you know, how has this field evolved to where it is right now, to the kind of work you're doing right now? So like what has changed and what are people focusing on now versus what they were focusing on maybe 10 years ago?
Yeah, so I would say that there's actually not that much research into keyboard shortcuts. There's a little bit here and there. It's more part of a bigger research area, which is kind of sort of like novice to expert transitions. And in particular, it's looking at like creating new interaction techniques to help those. There's a few trends here. So I think one of the biggest trends is something called a rehearsal-based interface. And I alluded to this a little bit. And it's basically the idea that currently when I enter a keyboard shortcut, I'm an expert, right? So when I do that, it's entirely disjoint from the way that a novice would do it. So a novice would click on a button or something like that. And what that means is that I haven't learned anything as a novice that I can apply to using an expert. And that's a bad thing because that means when you transition from using novice techniques to expert techniques, then you don't have any transfer of knowledge. And it makes that transition even more difficult. And it means that it's likely when you actually make that transition that there'll be a dip in your performance, or at least this is kind of like a positive thing. And so that's a part of it. And so I think that's one big trend, is that we're starting to look more and more at using rehearsal-based interfaces. And those really started out back in, they were kind of sort of originally introduced by Gordon Kurtenbach, who introduced the marking menu. And he's kind of, I guess, a grandfather of the field. That's a weird sentence. I hope we cut that. And it leads to another thing, which is I think that we're kind of, at least in my own work, we're stepping away from looking at interaction techniques, and we're moving more towards proposing and understanding more of why people don't use things like keyboard shortcuts and more expert techniques. And that performance step I alluded to was that is actually from a paper, Dips and Ceilings. I believe the first author is Joey Scar, and then my co-author Andy Coburn is also on that paper. And that's a really great paper that kind of talks about this potential dip. And there's this big push to start to like understand why these techniques might be effective and stuff like that, rather than just proposing techniques. I think that's a big trend in the literature as well. And in my own research, I hope to adopt that a little bit. And there's also like the application of like, there's been a lot of research in the history looking at like, I talked earlier in the podcast about satisficing. And I hope that, that's kind of older research. And there's also like this idea of a production bias, which is where people don't sacrifice productivity now for productivity in the future. And so I think the research, at least in my own research, is kind of trending more towards understanding these psychological problems and hoping to solve those through interaction techniques as well, which I think is really exciting.
Right. Fascinating stuff.
Did that answer your question at all?
I think so. So another paper that you've worked on, a set of interaction techniques you've worked on, is, again, this is kind of tied to the research that you were talking about, which is novice to expert transitions. And this one is titled Finger Arc and Finger Chord. And I find this is a really fascinating paper because I think correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not very familiar with this research space, but it feels like a lot of research is looking at how we can design maybe potentially like software inside of those new systems so that we can enable like shortcuts to be more easily recognizable, memorizable. Whereas this is kind of flipping it on its head a little bit, because this is looking at how can we use external systems, potentially like sensing in this case, to enable people to like maximize their use or understanding or recollection of shortcuts based on physical things that they're doing. Because, you know, when we're activating shortcuts, we are using our fingertips, right? And so I'm really, really interested to hear about this project.
So there's a bunch of things I want to say here. So the first one, this isn't my first author work. And this is work done by Jingdi Zhang, myself, Jeff Avery, and my old advisor, Daniel Vogel, while I was at the University of Waterloo. And so just for the audience to quickly introduce what finger-aware shortcuts are. So this is follow-on work So this paper that Karthik is talking about is follow-on work from Jingji's original work, which is finger-aware shortcuts. And it's the idea that when we press on a key, we might use different fingers, and the keys might be aware of it, and we can increase like the number of ways that you can press a shortcut. And he took this work and he expanded it to use a rehearsal-based interface, in fact. And so the idea was that, if you press on a key, maybe there could be a menu that opens depending on the angle of your thumb when you press on the key. So if it's a right angle, it might be one command. If it's your thumb and forefinger are kind of connected, then it might be another one. And if you have like a 30-degree angle or whatever, or 45-degree angle, then it might be a different command. And so you asked a bunch of questions, which makes it really hard to answer them. In this work, there's a bunch of really interesting things about this. So one of them is the idea of like using physicality to kind of help us remember things better. And I think that has a big impact on people learning things, right? Like there's just more associated with how we do something. So it seems like it should help us remember. And then I think the really cool thing about this paper, from my perspective, is there's kind of two ways we can improve keyboard shortcuts. And one of them is by like choosing better shortcuts. And I think that's really interesting because we're kind of running out of room to choose better shortcuts. One of the ways we run out of room is like one of the best ways to make a shortcut memorable is like take find. Find and F start with the same thing. Find starts with F. Therefore, it's memorable, right? Find, command, mm-hmm. F. That's pretty easy to remember. But if you can think of another command like format or something like that, then there's no longer this strong association because you can't use F anymore. You might be able to use option F, but now you're confused, right? Because now you've got like this overloading of things. And so we've kind of run out of something that I like to call, and I think this kind of comes more from Daniel Vogel, is expressive space, right? So there's only so much space that we can express a command in. And by adding more expressive space, such as by controlling the angle of your thumb, you might have more space to like give memorable commands. I can't think of any of off the top of my head for this particular project. But here's a good example. So let's say that you want to save something. You can save as, or you can like you can save a copy, and you can imagine mapping that to the angle of your thumb based on like if your thumb and forefinger are very close together, then you're saving to the same spot. And if you point away, then you're saving to a different spot, right? And that just makes sense. Like you can totally imagine a shortcut where that like now you've got more space to talk about what that command really is, and you can map that better. So I think that's one of the really exciting things about doing stuff like enabling new sensing to improve the expressive space. And I think there's a huge amount of opportunity to like continue improving the expressive space.
All right. So maybe we can step out of research and talk about Blaine. Blaine outside of research, because you're a very interesting person outside of research. You have a lot of interests. So I want the viewers to get to know you better. So maybe I'll tell you what I think of you before you actually describe who you are.
This is scary.
So Blaine's a very enthusiastic person, and he's an avid cyclist. He loves biking. He loves coffee. He loves, I don't know, coming up with interesting things to do. And he loves working on crazy things like art with JavaScript. He's just a very interesting person. I don't know. I'll let you tell us who you are.
Sure. Like Karthik, I don't know who I am. It's a really hard question, and now I regret asking him. I feel really bad for our future guests, to be honest. It turns out that answering questions is hard. Who am I? It's a hard question. I'm kind of whoever I want to be in the moment, I guess is the best way to describe it. I think that Karthik hit the nail on the head. I don't know if I'd ever use the words avid cyclist to describe myself, but I love my bike. I'm going to turn the camera, but you probably can't see it, but I basically sleep with my bike. My room is very small, but there's an important place in it for my bike. When I go somewhere, I just feel so free when I ride my bike, you know? So it feels so good to be able to just like get places by my own human power. And I guess I value that in like a bunch of different ways. I rock climb. I love hiking and stuff. I've done like bike touring. So I kind of just love the idea of getting places by my own power. So I'm a pretty physically active person, which is kind of killing me in the quarantine thing. And then I kind of just like doing random stuff. Like Karthik said, I'm trying to like spearhead this thing in our lab where every Friday at 2:30, we just like make some computer generated art. And my most recent artwork was something called morning lattes. And it's spelled morning as in the funeral morning, right? And that's because I can't drink lattes anymore because I can't go to coffee shops. So it's just like this visualization of all of the lattes that I drink. And I drink a lot of them. So I love coffee. And I love the concept of coffee more than the coffee sometimes. I just love like just sitting in a coffee shop and just like soaking things in, you know. I'm a pretty mindful person in that sense. I'm enthusiastic. I love people. When I can put up with them, when I can't, then I kind of don't love them so much. But I like plants. I'm this weird person who's like really creative, but like also awful at expressing that creativity sometimes. Like I can always think of these things I want to draw and I'm like, oh, I can picture it. But like, no matter how I just can't like create that picture using a pencil, which is what excites me about like computer art, because suddenly I can actually create that because we're taking something I'm good at, which is programming, and something else I'm good at, which is creativity. And sometimes I can actually like create that, which is cool. I don't know who else I am, to be honest. I've done some cool stuff there. I've done some like pretty big multi-pitch climbs, or one pretty big multi-pitch climb, which I think is like my crowning achievement in climbing. It was like, how big was it? It's called Bunny Bucket Buttress, and it's in Australia. I lived there for a little while, and it's really tall. It's like one of the scariest things I've done in my entire life. I do a bunch of rock climbing. I love rock climbing, actually. Who else am I? I'm also, I don't know, I don't want to create this false image of me as doing all of these awesome things and being all these great things. I also love laying in my bed. I love spending too many hours playing chess when I'm supposed to be doing a paper. I do this all the time. I have all of these like super destructive habits where like the closer I get to a deadline, the less work I do until I'm like close enough that like suddenly I'm like, oh no, I have to do all of the work in the next couple of hours. Otherwise, everything's going to go wrong.
We had that just last week.
Yeah. Karthik experienced this of me being super stressed out on like Tuesday and Wednesday. And I don't think I did any work on Tuesday. And it was due at 9 on Wednesday. And then I'm like, oh no, I have to do all of this work. And then, yeah, then I had to do it. So I don't want to paint this like picture that I'm like some perfect PhD student with all of these fun hobbies and stuff. I want to be careful with that because I think it's important that people realize that, like, I don't know, I struggle just like everybody else does. So,
absolutely, yeah. Especially these times, like, it's hard, but you know, we're doing this, and this will keep us busy and occupied. So,
yeah,
it'd be nice.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, especially in these hard times. Karthik makes a really good point there. Is that, like, I think it's really important that we, like, especially if we're going to publish this, that we paint a realistic picture that, research is hard and it sucks sometimes, and I'm doing it for a reason, so it doesn't entirely suck, but there are some weeks, months, semesters mm-hmm. that just I don't feel good about myself during, and I don't have anything from those semesters, and that's fine.
Part of the experience.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this 0th episode. If we've piqued your interest, grab a cup and join us next time.